to Beyond the Rock podcast. My name is Emily Hernandez, and I'm here with
Jeremy Arns.
And today our guest is Jason Kale. How you doing, Jason?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Doing nice. Awesome. Thank you for asking. How's your day treating you so far?
Good. Pretty chill day at home. Yeah. Nothing too exciting. This is the most exciting thing that's happened today, so.
Did you hear that, Jeremy? We're the most exciting thing that's happened today.
Yeah. I'm just taking care of that sweet baby.
Oh.
Nice.
Yeah. Doing some work around the house.
How's she doing?
She's doing awesome. Yeah. She's almost two and just getting crazier every day. And yeah, super fun.
That's awesome. You and your wife actually have a unique story. Do you mind sharing how you two met?
Sure. We met in Waco Tanks climbing, and she was mutual friends, kind of climbing partner, and I was their ride for like a month and a half when they were visiting. She's from Slovenia, and she was here for a couple months climbing in Waco, and I convinced her to stick around, and we traveled the U.S. together in a van for a long time, and now we're back in, you know, the place where we met. So yeah, we're super psyched to be living in El Paso near Waco Tanks.
That's awesome. And that kind of leads into one question I had, like, why Waco? Were you there? You were there before you met your wife, or is it?
I've been coming down here since probably, I think 96 was the first year I came to Waco Tanks, and coming back every year, kind of a winter destination, kept extending the trips longer and longer. And I think one year I spent like 6 months down here. That's when I was helping out at the Rock Ranch, kind of like the climbers camp and everything. And wasn't really my choice. We were living in Boulder, Colorado, and my wife was doing her residency emergency medicine, and she applied to like 150 different locations, and she got two interviews. One was in El Paso, one was in St. Louis, which would also have been awesome because my company I work with, So Ill, is based out of there. But we ended up, you know, landing in El Paso, and we were like really both happy that worked out.
Yeah, that's a great place to land for sure.
Yeah.
And I believe you're an author, yes? Did you just come out with the...
I did. I actually have it right here. A couple copies.
I recognize
that guy. Waco Tanks. The new guidebook for North Mountain. I'm working on the next book, which will be for all the other mountains, which is considered the backcountry. But this book is for North Mountain, which is the most accessible mountain where anyone can go without a guide.
Do you, just for the people who are not familiar with the vibe of Waco Tanks, do you mind explaining the guiding and non-guiding aspect and where the accessibility is?
Sure. Basically, Waco Tanks is this amazing state park, but it's also a historical site, and there's tons of artifacts and rock paintings. It's actually the largest location of painted masks in North America. So it's super protected area, and throughout the probably 70s and 80s, it was really getting destroyed by locals, not climbers, but just people going out there. You could drive your car like up to the maze, which if you've been there, it's like, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. But they destroyed it, and basically it got turned into this state park historical site to try and save it. And to do that, they had to come up with all these regulations. And basically there's four mountains, and one of them is accessible for everyone. That's the one that's closest to the office. That's the one that's, I guess, easiest to get around with because it's a lot of rock and not a lot of, you know, off trail, you know, bushes and stuff like that. So that's open for anyone. Anyone can come anytime and check it out and hike around. But then the rest of the park is more rugged and not as easy to get around, and that you need a guide to go out to access it in any way, even if you want to go look at paintings or just hike around or climbing. So the climbers have kind of all come together, and there's all different kind of groups, concessions that guide people, and there's tons of ways to get into the park now for climbers and for everyone.
So how did the idea of updating the guidebook come about?
Well, I think I was talking with Matt Wilder. He wrote the last version. There's like three or four, you know, books. John Sherman has two editions, and I think there was an older book before that, and then Matt Wilder's book. And he doesn't have the time. He's super busy with work and his life and everything. And me being down here and knowing a lot of the climbing and a lot of my friends going out and knowing a lot about the climbing, it was kind of like, you know, I was the guy with the feet down on the street there, and they're like, okay, like, why don't you do it? And kind of didn't want to do it at first, you know, because it just sounds really daunting. And you want to do a good job, and you want to, you know, get everything in there and get it right. And, you know, so kind of reluctantly decided to join on to the project with Wolverine. Wolverine Publishing is, you know, also helping with the book, and just kind of happened. So, and I'm here and I know most of it. So it was just kind of made sense that I got into the project.
That's awesome. So what process did you use to handle that daunting task? Anything or just?
Well, a lot of research, you know, looking at the older books and, you know, a lot of just getting out there and checking things out was the big thing, because in the older books, not everything had a photo. So maybe there was a description of something, but you didn't know what it looked like. So you probably wouldn't even really check it out. So I tried to get photos of everything. And that meant just basically tackling things area by area. We kind of laid out, you know, like the map and where we were going to be, kind of the direction it was going. And then just going out all the time and, you know, trying to get all the information. And a lot of times I'd end up having to go back, you know, because I missed something, or, you know, the picture wasn't great enough, or so yeah, it's a lot of work, and I don't know, it feels like, you know, you just got to keep working at something like that. Like, you keep going and doing it and doing it, and finally things start getting ticked off, and eventually it feels like you've done something. In the beginning, it was definitely like very overwhelming.
Did you ever get to a point where you thought you were done and then realize that you'd forgot a problem or something?
I mean, yeah, like all the time. Like,
okay.
Up to the time that we went to print, I was like, some people have been trying this problem. We need to downgrade it. Or, you know, like, there's one more thing that we need to, like, you know, a lot of things get pushed into the book towards the end, and maybe they don't have like a consensus. So, you know, you just want everything to be as correct as possible and get people the right information.
That's awesome. Me and the guy that I started climbing with, our second outdoor trip was to Waco Tanks, and we had Sherman's book with the black and white photos. And so you're just trying to find the right angle of the boulder and like, okay, it kind of looks like that. And then luckily we found some climbers climbing in Martini Cave and just kind of worked our way back. And that was our first time using
a book. Yeah. If all you have is a book, it's your first time. It is not easy.
Yeah.
Definitely helpful to find someone or meet a friend to show you around.
Yeah. But by the time we left 3 days later, we were telling people where to go.
Yeah.
I can imagine the process with writing a book like that. And, I've listened to and read a few interviews of yours, and it seems like you're a very methodical human being as an artist and as a hold. Do you call it a hold developer, hold shaper?
Hold shaper, hold designer. Yeah.
Now, is that a consistent thing in your life? Meaning, kind of like in the cooking world, mise en place, everything is in its place.
Yeah, definitely. 100%. Like, I mean, I'm the same way with cooking, you know, it's like you can make an egg sandwich or you can make a fun little piece of art, you know, it's the amount of effort you put into something and, you know, the thought behind something, I think, is important no matter what you're doing. And I think that's what separates art from just, you know, throwing something together and, you know, commonplace. So yeah, and I like to, you know, put thought into everything, and, you know, there's always some kind of hidden magic, you know, there that you probably wouldn't notice if you weren't paying attention.
I do agree. And I see that you supremely enjoy creating and you share it with the social media community. You have a fantastic reputation. Do you consider yourself a master in any of these, I don't want to say hobbies, but any of these, if I could find the word, that'd be great. But do you consider yourself a master in anything or a forever student?
Definitely a forever student. And I mean, I do hold shaping, and I also do gym design. And in those things, it's like, you know, it's more important to learn how to do everything. Let me see, it's kind of complicated, but if it's not just, you know, doing it, you know, it's understanding how to do it so you can do it any way you want to do it. I feel like a lot of people, you know, they'll do something like, okay, I finished it, I got the project done, there it is. But that's not really enough, you know. It's like you want to understand every which way, everything that's possible that you could do in these circumstances, and then you have the ability to, you know, play with that. And I think you'll get better results, you know, when you understand something and then you can play in that realm, more so than, you know, just trying to, you know, complete a project.
So for me, that kind of sounds like you are a professional in each of these, and maybe trying to be a master?
Yeah, I mean, I try to learn as much about it as I can. And when it starts feeling easy, you know, then you're kind of like, oh, okay, you know, I'm in that arena where you can just go in there and have fun with it, be it hold shaping or books or, you know, designing gyms. Yeah, it's like the very first time you do something, you're making all these mistakes constantly, you know, and that's the learning process, really.
I agree.
I was just curious, as a person, I've never put up an FA. I've never got a chance to name a bouldering problem. What do you have any, like, system, or what is your thought process on naming problems and routes?
I try to write things down that I hear that I find interesting or weird. So I have a list on my phone and on my computer. You know, I'll hear a word and I'll be like, huh, that is an interesting word. It makes you think. I also like to, you know, add some spice to a route, you know, like, let's say it's a little bit scary and the name says so much about it, and the name can make the next person who goes to try it more fearful. It can make them intimidated. Like, the name says a lot. So I think it's really cool to be able to name something and, you know, project that. But at the same time, I try not to get too wrapped up in names, and I never really name things before they're done, because I kind of think it's a curse.
That makes sense.
You know,
you're
getting ahead of yourself if you're naming things before they're done.
I know there are a few things at Waco that maybe few problems that might have problematic names, but you have any thoughts on, I know that it's been going around every once in a while of renaming some boulder problems that have maybe not.
Yeah. Not explicit, yeah. Or for sure. I actually got a lot of people approach me while I was working on the book about getting some of the name changes. And you know, it's tough, because, you know, in one aspect, you know, you want to give everyone, you know, their right of whatever freedom to name it what they want. And if someone names something, you know, 20 years later, they look in the book and they change the name and they're like, well, you know, why did they change my name? But I totally get it. Like, especially nowadays, climbing is like all about the kids. It's definitely a different place. I mean, I was told by Sherman, who wrote the original books, that he basically didn't have names, and he went to like the porn shop and found all these names. Like, I mean, I would have looked someplace else, but you know, that's what happened. So we try to keep, you know, true to that, I think a couple things got changed. I know there's one wall, it's like the little itty bitty adolescent titties. Like, yeah. I dropped the adolescent part off of it. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. It's still, everyone knows what it is, but it's like, you know, it's just too much, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's hard, you know? I mean, we could, you know, censor it out, but at the same time, people still know what it says. Like,
yeah.
F dot dot, like, okay. I get it, you know?
Yeah. Well, last time we were out there, Rocco was telling us about how they have to, when they call in stuff from the backcountry, you have to use different, mm-hmm. different terms. Mm-hmm. And we ended up having to explain to two of the women that were in our group what a donkey show was, which was mm-hmm. kind of awkward.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's some weird stuff out there. And it's also weird, you know, to have to tell someone at your job or something that you went out and sent this problem. And it's here in Austin, we have a problem called fuck nut, or a lot of people call it uh-huh. F nut, because, you know, like, you don't necessarily want to tell people that.
No.
Or your mom asked you what you did today.
Exactly.
Oh, I said fuck nut.
Yeah.
Sorry, what?
Yeah, exactly.
Totally.
So I'm a computer programmer, and one of the things that happens to me is you'll go back like a year later, or a couple of years later, and look at some code, and you're like, what idiot wrote this? Mm-hmm. Have you ever gone back to a problem that you've FA'd or named, and you've forgotten that you FA'd it or named it, and been like, what idiot put up this problem? You know what I mean? Has something like that ever happened?
not in that sense, but definitely there are some things that I have forgotten. I'm not much for like keeping lists. I know a lot of climbers sure. like have lists of everything they've done, and I try to do some stuff that's more memorable than, you know, I won't necessarily need a list because it was such a memorable experience. I would say more in the design end, you know, like I look at some old shapes I've done, I've been like, wow, that's pretty wonky. Or like the first gym I designed was, you know, very difficult because I was still learning the program. And then, you know, three gyms later, I was like, I could go back and redesign that gym and, you know, it would be like way better. But I guess that's the learning process.
Yeah. Have you ever named a problem and then thought like 20 years later, oh, that's problematic, maybe I shouldn't have done that? Or
No.
Okay.
I try to keep it pretty respectful.
There you go.
And yeah, I'm more interested in like making people think about it than, you know, offending someone or just trying to be vulgar or like shock people.
The only reason I ask is when you're younger, sometimes you're a little bit, some people are, I know when I was younger, I was a little bit more like, you know, I would go for the shock and all of some things I would say or do or whatever.
For sure. I'm sure there's something out there.
Fair enough.
I've forgotten about.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I have one more question on this topic, and this comes from my friend Brian, because I don't know anything about it, but he says that he has seen you post stuff on Instagram of FAs, and you have not documented the grades or names.
Yeah.
And he wanted to know what's going on with that.
What's up with that, man?
I don't know what they're rated, and I climb by myself all the time, and I always climb with bad beta.
Fair enough.
And honestly, like, I don't care. I want to climb because it looks cool, the movement's cool, it's awesome, and people can figure out the grade later. Like, I mean, it looked hard, whatever, it's probably, you know, in the hard range, 10 to 12-ish. Yeah, I don't know. It's just never been something I've wanted to throw out there. And I mean, I don't know. I like things to be consistent, and I don't know anything by doing the first ascent. A lot of times people come along with different beta. Most of the time people come along with different beta. Maybe I didn't see something or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. I don't like putting a number on it. And that's the thing. It's like, I don't like people who are out there climbing for numbers. And a lot of times I see that, or I hear that from people. They're like, oh yeah, I just went to Waco for the first time and I did my first V8. And I'm like, that means absolutely nothing to me. Like, what was the name of the climb? Does it have any history behind it? Was it a high ball? Was it a crazy roof? that is more important, you know, to me. And I think back to the, you know, the names, you know, a name has a lot of history behind it. You know, you hear about C-Spot Run and you hear it's this great, you know, highball face and you're like, okay, that's really serious, you know, like,
yeah.
So yeah, I just don't care. Like I never really considered myself like a jock climber. Like I'm not here because I'm an athlete. I'm not here because I'm into fitness. I'm more into exploring and I want to be outside and I want to find cool things to climb and cool movement and crazy looking rocks. And like, it's just my style of climbing.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And speaking of the history, you know, climbs, I'm sure, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've been invited to some pretty, you know, secretive or exclusive bouldering areas across the world. What's like the power and the meaning that you get from these very exclusive or unique climbs? Like I've read in different interviews, you talk about the history. What does that mean to you?
The history of the area or?
The route.
Just the route. I don't know. I think it's everything, you know. I don't know. I feel like climbing has kind of gotten lost in this kind of internet, Instagram posing. I'm famous. Where, you know, when I started climbing, like if you wanted to be a sponsored climber and you wanted to be, you know, accepted or known as a sponsored climber, you needed to do something badass. And people would hear about it and people would be like, oh, wow, like I went to Bishop and I looked at that climb, Evolution or whatever. And they're like, okay, now I understand what you're talking about here. It's not just because you have, you know, 50,000 likes or whatever. That's what's important. And that's the same thing going back to the names, like a name has history and all that. And I don't know, just traveling to different areas and I don't know, I feel like I always wanted to be more of, you know, like developing the area instead of just going and sampling what was already there. So when I was traveling a lot, I was always looking for the next thing to climb. And even going to popular areas like Yosemite and Bishop and those areas, I was, you know, always trying to add to the history, you know, not just repeat what had been done. And that to me was like the most important, you know, for climbing and for, you know, just being part of climbing, like the history of climbing.
You know, that's definitely something that hurts my heart is that I feel that the, you know, respect for the trailblazers and the history of climbing and all of its different forms kind of gets lost because climbing has gone from kind of an extreme to a mainstream kind of thing. So how do you think we as a community encourages that etiquette and that respect for people who don't have any idea?
I don't know. I feel like, yeah, there needs to be more historical, you know, documentation. I think there has been, you know, like with some of the real rock stuff where they're going back and, you know, examining a situation and like talking about it. But yeah, a lot of climbers, especially newer climbers, don't know the history. And you're like, Lynn Hill, they're like, who's Lynn Hill? And you're like, okay, just stop climbing and like pick up a bunch of old books and magazines and just read for a while, you know? And because I grew up in it, like starting climbing in the 90s, like, and because it was so slow, you know, there wasn't internet. You didn't see what everyone did every single day. You know, 5 videos came out a year and you collected those and you watched them over and over and over. And you got the magazine subscription and you're like just obsessing over, you know, what you're seeing. It's like so different than, you know, how it comes at you now. So yeah, just people telling more history. I don't know. I think it's interesting. I think some climbers nowadays find it interesting. I know there's like a climbing museum in Phoenix. I don't know if you guys have heard of that. This is Marty Carabiner or something. He's like has this climbing museum, bunch of like artifacts and stuff from climbing, but stuff like that's super cool, and hopefully there'll be more of a place for it in the future with all the climbers coming up.
I would say that that's still kind of out there. That you said like the five videos come out a year, but to me, that I started climbing 3 years ago, and I know who Lynn Hill is, and I know who all those people are. Like, you can watch all the real rocks, like you said. There's Valley Uprising, obviously Free Solo and Dawn Wall are super popular, and with some of them you do get some history. But yeah, I mean, I think it's still, you still got to do the work. And having gone through a journeyman apprenticeship program when I was younger in theater, I feel like climbing historically has been like a journeyman apprentice situation. You would find somebody that knew more than you to take you outside to do it.
Sure.
And then they would teach you the ethics and all that. And I was lucky enough to, when I first started, to run into a few people that showed me around.
Yeah.
And they told me, like, this is how you act when you climb outside. This is not, this is not the gym. This is, you know what I mean? And, but the thing that worries me is that more and more people that get into climbing, there are more apprentices than there are journeymen to teach them.
Yeah.
And then that's where I worry about it. And, you know, people climbing, I know it's a big thing that Jason always tries to talk about is don't climb on wet rock, right? Mm-hmm. Especially at Waco. And yeah. I think on Granite, you can climb when it's wet, but man, it's like when it rains around here, I go to E-Rock, but.
Well, with that, my question, Jason, is what do you think is like one of the most misunderstood things about rock climbing in the mainstream? If you were to share that.
Misunderstood. Well, there's nothing really to be misunderstood, but climbing is whatever you make it, and there's all types of climbing. And, you know, the type of climbing I want to do, which is exploring and being alone in the wilderness, is not the type of climbing that other people want, you know, friends and, you know, tons of pads and yeah, it's like a day out at the gym. Like, climbing's cool like that because there's so many different aspects of it. You can go trout climbing, you can be a sport climber, like, so it's hard to say like what one thing would be. I think just, you know, find what you like about it yourself and kind of, I don't know, I stick to that, you know. And people are like, oh, will you ever grow tired of it? And I'm like, there's no way I can grow tired of it because it's what I want to do. And I'm not doing it for any other reason than for myself. You know, I'm not doing it because this is what's popular now. I'm not doing it because I want to become famous off of it. I'm doing it because I want to go outside every chance I can and explore the rocks and see crazy things and figure out crazy movements. And yeah, so I think it's such an individual sport, if you want to call it a sport, that, yeah, there's like not really one answer.
That is actually one of the questions that I had for you specifically. I have heard such different opinions on, is it a sport? Is it not a sport? Mm-hmm. What's your take on that out of curiosity?
I mean, kind of like what I just said, yes, it is a sport, but you don't have to treat it like a sport. I mean, some people, you know, training for the Olympics, that's a sport. When I go out, I don't consider that sport, you know? And yeah, I'm not, it's not like I'm headed to Planet Fitness to get a workout, you know, it's totally different. And when I started climbing, it was definitely not a sport. And when I started going on the road, it was a lifestyle, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to just, you know, climb. I wanted to be the climber, you know. I wanted to be the dirtbag climber. I wanted to be camping all the time. I wanted to be, you know, at a different area every month. And that to me was like the embodiment of climbing, you know. It was like, okay, I climb, but this is my life. So like, I am a climber, you know. But yeah, I don't see it as a sport. I see myself as more of an explorer, and it's physical explorer as far as, you know, exploring movement and, you know, physically finding rocks that are, you know, amazing and like these awesome apparatuses that you can like explore, you know, how they can be conquered.
I do. The video that introduced me to you and Waco Tanks was one of Friction Labs. It's maybe about 13-ish minutes.
Yeah.
And I mean, everything from the God, sounds like drone, everything from the drone footage, yeah, to the time lapse, to the music, the beats, the way that you narrate, I think you paint a beautiful picture of what organic climbing really is about, the exploration, the discovery, the respect. How did you feel about doing that video? Did it capture everything that you wanted to share about Waco Tanks, or?
Yeah, I think so. And I usually do my own videos, so that was kind of interesting working with someone else.
Yeah.
I think it came out true to, you know, to what I'm doing and what I feel about climbing. A lot of my videos are a little stranger and a little more abstract. So I think that's a good, you know, like, true example of, you know, me and Waco in that video.
Your videos are very interactive and awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
The visuals that you have. Have you always been into video? I think it was the most recent Real Rock, even, and I think I've told you this before, when you slap onto a slipper and there's just blood coming from
your...
Angles that y'all had even back then were just great. Was that just what you were into?
I was always into video, and, you know, when I was a kid, I was filming our family vacations, and then I started making, like, zombie movies and ninja movies, you know, when I was a kid, and, like, I was totally into, like, special effects, blood and gore and all that stuff, and that's where the blood from the Joe's Valley thing came from. That was kind of like, I want to set up this shot. I have this idea for the shot where I grab the hold and the blood squirts out, and like my friend stood behind me and we had like a tube of blood in it, you know, he squeezed it when I hit the hold. But just those kind of like fun, like illusionary kind of things where, you know, you see it and you're like what's going on? Like, you know, even in whatever my little post on like Instagram, I try to like do something that, you know, if you're paying attention, like, you'll be like, what? Wait a second, what was that? You know, like.
Yes, I do know.
So I have a question, because it's come up several times now. As a person who was there and an integral part of the development of Joe's Valley, how did that United States of Joe's clip come off to you? Did it portray it well, or?
Yeah, I think so. Especially, you know, having like the locals be a part of it was awesome. Yeah. Because I mean, it's really always rumors, you know, what they think of climbers. Yeah. But it definitely has that whole canned Real Rock, you know, vibe where, yeah, basically they tell the athlete to say something. They're like, oh yeah, you know, and they just, they have a formula for those movies, you know. Yeah. I've been in a couple, and it's definitely a formula, and that's how good stories are told. And that's why it's entertaining. One story I have from Joe's Valley, which didn't make it into the cut, was we were there for a couple of months, and I was hanging out with this guy, Dr. Topo. If you know any of the Dr. Topo, he used to do these free online guides and videos and stuff. So this Canadian guy, Dr. Topo, and I was hanging out with this dreaded, long, blonde, dreaded guy named Yuri, and then this other black guy named Johnny, and we were like the odd group for sure, and we were out bouldering one day, and this kid pulls up alongside of, you know, the road's right there. He's like, hey, you know, would you guys want to come over to our house? Because it was just Thanksgiving, and this kid and his family invited us into their house because they had Thanksgiving leftovers.
Oh, wow.
And we went there that night and had dinner with this full-on Mormon family, this, you know, ragtag group of guys who weren't like anything any of those people were used to seeing. And we had a nice dinner. They were like super friendly, and they treated us with respect, and it was awesome. So yeah, it's cool how that place is amazing. I mean, Joe's Valley, the climbing's amazing, and then you have that really cool small town where people seem to be, you know, embracing it more and more.
Yeah, that's awesome. I got choked up during that segment.
Nice.
I was like, wow, that's a really cool history, and it was nice to learn about. So the first time you roll in the Joes Valley, you see thousands of boulders or whatever it is. Did you just, you're like, oh man, did you start salivating? Or
yeah, I mean, you almost want to, you almost drive off the road because, well, first the road's so narrow and winding, but then it's like you need someone else to drive so you can just stare at all the boulders. But yeah, the first time I went was probably like 2000, and we had a little guide that was in Climbing Magazine or something. They, you know, they put out a little guide. And we were there for the winter trade show at the OR, and we're like, oh, we'll check this Joes Valley place out. It looks awesome. And we went there and it was freezing, and we camped out, and we just froze. We like didn't understand the time, you know, January was a bad time. And we just went and checked it out, and we were so psyched. And yeah, definitely a good trip. I remember my first time anywhere, but yeah, Joes Valley is spectacular.
That's awesome. Do you think that there are still undiscovered places
around there?
Yeah. No, I mean, like in the United States or in the world. I mean, I know in the world, but like in the United States.
For sure. I mean, there's rock everywhere, and you know, maybe it's a matter of hiking longer or whatever, but like it's kind of crazy. You know, it's such a weird activity climbing. You know, you're like, oh, you know, there's some climbs here and there. Many places there aren't. You know, I grew up in Maryland where there's not, but like in the whole scheme of things, there are so many rocks to be climbed. It's ridiculous. It's like, it's endless, and you're never gonna, you know, you're never gonna see it all. You're never gonna even like tap into like, I don't know, like a third of, even in the US, like there's so much rock out there. It's crazy.
Speaking of rock, I would love to talk to you about your first highball boulder, or the one that was on, I think it was, or I don't know if it would be considered your first one, Evolution?
Not my first one, but definitely the first one that was major and people took notice, you know. Yeah, do you have any specific question or just...
Well, I want to know when the real deal first highball that you identified and you knew that you were taking your bouldering from what you had been, I don't know if even I could say normally doing, to the next level, or, you know, like when that step was.
That was probably it for sure, Evolution in Bishop. But I'd always been into like higher things, or you know, practicing something with a rope and then and doing it without. But that one really stuck out because, you know, we're all there. It was kind of a, you know, a destination at that time also, 2001 or whenever that was. So there's like tons of climbers there. Everyone's going there in the winter and stuff. And went there, and I mean, that wall is amazing. That boulder itself is amazing. It's like the first thing you see when you drive up. And the climb that was established was, you know, just the face climb, and you know, you get to the lip and you jump down. Chris Sharma established that, and it was like, you know, the Sharma face or whatever. And some of my friends were trying it, and I was like, why are you guys even trying this if you're not going to top it out? Because I mean, some things, you know, have been done that were tall, and there's definitely tons of crazy tall highballs in Bishop already. But I think that was, you know, it was also because of the difficulty, you know, and being difficult at that height. But yeah, basically I really wasn't interested in trying it unless I wanted to try and do it, which meant top it out. And, that was kind of what sparked the whole thing. And, yeah, just started working it. And, yeah, it was pretty major. I was like on a mission, you know. I was like there, and like I remember driving up there that day, like, you know, like getting ready to do it, and it was like, yeah, it was like a serious mission.
And that's the Peabody boulder?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So with that, I had watched Daniel Woods did a different line at the 15 or 16. And he talked a lot about breath work and how he had to have three different styles of breathing when he did that. Besides having your mental state, do you do different types of breath work as you approach high balls like that? Or like, do you have a meditation practice? Do you,
I usually hold my breath the entire time.
I think that's the best way.
And then I just scream really loud when it's hard. No, I mean, I try to stay calm. You know, a lot of times when you're starting out to like do something or you're giving an attempt, you start to get nervous and you start to get scared and you start to feel weird. But I always tell myself that, you know, that's normal. Like that weirdness you're feeling is part of, you know, the process. You know, if you walked up and you were like, oh yeah, this is going to be fun, let's do it. You know, like that's weird, you know? So this anticipation, these butterflies, like I always take that as kind of like a good thing. And I always kind of tell myself that that's just the starting of the process of, you know, getting ready. And I'm not like really into breathing or meditation, yes, but not in like the, you know, the standard sense of the word. More just positive thinking and going over movements in your head and, you know, envisioning success, stuff like that. I think it's all mental, you know, and it's all about controlling yourself and controlling your mind but not relaxing too much at the same time. Like you don't want to get injured because you didn't care, you know?
Well, my last question on that is what was the sensation when you went from the lip over and realized that you were headed up towards sending that in 02 evolution? Do you remember?
I mean, crazy, yeah. And I think I almost fell like at the last move.
Oh no.
I don't know. There's like, I've had these moments in my climbing where, you know, I feel like something happens and you try so hard that, you know, no matter, you know, the outcome, like you're going to succeed because there's this, you know, thing in the back of your mind that's like not going to let it happen. I always have faith that, you know, like when it gets to that point, like, you know, I'm going to do what I need to do. But yeah, once you get past that point, and I think this is true in anything, because I mean, part of you, I think, has to think that maybe you can't do it, you know, like you're like, maybe I don't know if I can do this as a project. It's hard for me. Like I could fail for the rest of my life, you know, like that moment that you step over that, I think it's kind of euphoric, you know, it's kind of like your body's tingly and you're like, oh wow. Like, I haven't experienced this before, you know. It's like you kind of prove yourself wrong because there's always, you know, some amount of self-doubt.
Ooh, that's a beautiful, beautiful boulder.
Thanks. Yeah, it's
bravo. Crazy.
So before we run out of time, I definitely want to bring up the baby head thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, me too.
So
and arms and legs.
Is it true? I mean, is it true that you collect baby doll heads?
Well, I collect a bunch of weird stuff, but I think it started because when I was younger, I was really into like thrift shopping, weird stuff, thrift shopping, like just being like, oh, here's the weirdest hook that, you know, clamp, whatever. Like I go to these thrift shops and I just find the weirdest thing and I kind of like want to collect it. And then that kind of transformed into, okay, hey, there's a bunch of weird baby dolls that you can find at the thrift shop. And a lot of times on the road trips, we like have nothing to do. We're like, oh, let's go thrift shopping today. That just kind of like stuck. And I don't have a huge collection or anything right now, but I definitely have some random weird ones, and some people have sent me some random weird ones, and even some that look like me, like they cut the hair to like look like me. They've sent me some. I think it freaks people out a bit, and I don't know, I kind of think it should. It's like these weird rubber, you know, baby toys that are creepy, and we're giving them to our children, you know.
For sure.
But my daughter Ava, she likes all the creepy ones, so no problem there.
Yeah.
There you go. And then that leads to my least favorite hold in the world, which is the baby doll head hold.
The big one.
The big one, yeah.
Nice. Nice.
Which always, they have it, they, the bouldering gym, Austin Bouldering Project, has one, and it always ends up with a chalk mustache on it.
I know. That always infuriates me, but that always happens. And the story behind that one is, this is kind of funny. I did the original baby heads, which I don't know if you've seen them. They're the smaller ones.
No.
And basically, I just cut off baby doll heads and put them in the foam. And so when they molded them, you know, they have a dual texture. They're like shiny, and they're all, it's like a set of five baby doll heads, and they're not available anymore. They stopped making them. But so I wanted to do a big one. And after the first set of baby doll heads, Dan, who owns Soil, was like, no more baby heads. I think he got a bunch of people complaining. I think they sent a black copy to like a religious climbing wall or something. And they were like, what are up with these baby heads? He said, no more baby heads. And I was like, okay. And so I had this big block of foam that I'd always been saving to do this giant baby head. And so I eventually did it, and I didn't tell him, and I sneaked it into Aragon to get molded. And I was just hoping, you know, it would kind of just go through the process and get made into a hold, and then we'd have this baby doll head. And then I guess he found out, they called him, and they're like, what's up with this? Are we molding this? And he was like, what's up with this? And I'm like, no, let's do it. And he posted it online. He was like, you know, yes or no. Do you guys want to see this as a whole? And everyone was like, yes, let's do it. And it got through, luckily. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been made.
That's awesome.
Sometimes you just have to go for it.
Yeah.
Better to ask for forgiveness and permission sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, go with your gut. If it feels right, do it.
And speaking of that, what brought on your unique hairstyle? Did you go with your gut on that one? Because there was an old interview that I read about your mom being a hairstylist when you were mm-hmm. in high school.
Yeah.
And you said something that she used to cut your hair, and that was one of the main reasons you left the house. Was that a joke or?
Oh, I mean, yeah, probably a joke, but no, I just, she had cut my hair. She never really was into doing anything strange, you know? And so when I did travel and leave the house, I started doing more, you know, dyeing it and stuff like that. And then I had this book about mullets. And I think my mother actually got me the book about mullets. And there's this one haircut in it called The Offender, which was shaving in the front and long in the back. And I went, when I was in Salt Lake City, I had broken up with a longtime girlfriend and just kind of like hanging out with the boys and just, you know, getting wilder and wilder. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go cut my hair. Went to this place in Salt Lake City that does $5 haircuts. Asked if I could get a $2.50 haircut and just cut half of it. And they cut it, and it was blonde-ish, you know, in the beginning. And then eventually I dyed it black and eventually did the dreads. And I don't know. I like it. I like to have the front area free, and, you know, nothing's in my way. And I don't know. It goes back to the old kung fu flicks, you know, like... And I always kind of wanted dreads too, ever since when I was younger. Ben Moon was, you know, a hardcore climber, and he had dreads at one point. And I was like, oh, dreads are badass. And just kind of eventually happened. So
it was super cute. Thank you again for meeting the Texas Lady Crushers. And out at Waco Tanks, you gave us a wonderful referral.
Nice.
Natalie was amazing.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, is amazing. It was precious to see Ava playing. I have a couple pictures of her playing with your dreads. I'll email them to you.
Nice. Awesome.
Yeah.
She loves to go to Waco. So it's like.
One last question just in regards to that, and then I'll pass it over to Jeremy. We'll wrap it up. How has being a father changed or enhanced your world of climbing? How has it inspired it or motivated you?
Definitely motivated me. I mean, I go through ups and downs of psych, you know, I'm not like psyched all the time. And in fact, people who are psyched all the time turn me off. Like I'm just like, okay, like get away from me, like leave me alone. So yeah, I go through ups and downs of psych all the time. And, you know, even this past season, you know, I kind of had a slow start to the season. I wasn't very psyched. I didn't know what to focus on. I didn't know what I wanted to project. I was just like, oh, whatever. I have all the time in the world. And then I started gaining momentum towards the end of the season. And I had all these cool projects I was working on. And then, you know, the lockdown happened. And then I was like, okay, like, stop wasting time. you know, it's like, you never know when stuff's going to be taken away from you. So, I mean, if anything, being a father, you know, you kind of take your time, you know, you really appreciate your free time. And, you know, even, you know, training, we have a home wall here, and, you know, whenever I get a chance, I try to, you know, take advantage of that time. But I've also been enjoying taking her to Waco Tanks, and she loves exploring, and she's really into sliding down the rock slabs. So we go out, and yeah, she loves it out there, and she's always wants to go. She's always like, Waco, let's go.
You should do, when she gets maybe to, I don't know, 5 or 10 years old, get an imprint of her hand and have that be a mold. That'd be a really cool idea.
Yeah, for sure.
I just had one last question, and that was, so a lot of people during quarantine, a lot of people, including myself yesterday, building home walls.
Yeah.
And now more and more of my friends are talking about shaping their own holds at home, because pouring your own holds at home is definitely cheaper for your home wall.
Yeah, holds are crazy expensive.
So did you have any advice for people just getting into hold shaping?
I wouldn't even do it, but it's like kind of nasty and the chemicals are heinous. But any advice I could give, when I started, I started, you know, just kind of creating things that I liked. So I went to the gym and I was like, okay, these are the holds I really like. Why do I like them? You know, what is it about this hold that I think is fun, or I think is comfortable, or I think is, you know, interesting? And I tried to recreate those holds in the foam that you're shaping with. And that kind of really gave me a good understanding of why things are good. And, you know, why do you like the hold? Well, because my fingers don't touch the wall, or, you know, like it's round enough that it doesn't pinch me, or, you know, it has interesting thumb catches and stuff like that. That was huge for me, you know, because you know what you like, you know, when you see it or you climb on it, you're like, oh, this is really fun. So that, but I would also suggest, like, when I had a wall, like I made a lot of my own holds out of wood. It's way easier than shaping holds and making molds and pouring, you know, urethane. It's super cheap, and, you know, if you do a decent job, like, they can be good. I had tons of holds on my home wall that were just, like, you know, wooden edges or, you know, whatever. So, yeah, I think there's different ways to explore for people, you know, wanting to do home walls and, you know, I mean, to fill a wall, like, my wall's crazy filled, but because I make them, like, I wouldn't imagine most people, you know, wanting to spend that much money. The holds are outrageous. Even if you're getting a discount or whatever, they're still really expensive.
I can attest to that.
Yeah.
awesome, man. Well, so at the end of our interview, we used to like to do shout outs to people. And if you have some shout outs, that'd be awesome. If you don't, that's cool too. But let's start with Emily. What do you got?
Honestly, I'm going to shout out to the Waco Hacienda. It is in El Paso. And I am going to share my love for them because it is a phenomenal property that has a lot of love in it. It is less than 3 miles away from the park. You can rent crash pads from Send, which their facility is just right around the corner from the Hacienda. It's considered a premier lodging facility, and they really do strive to provide their guests with an amazing experience, and their management is phenomenal. They are owned by Brooklyn Boulders, And every time I've gone there, when I say every time, I mean two times, I have always had a wonderful experience and the accommodations are great and I never want to leave. So that's my shout out, the Hueco Hacienda. You can find them at huecohacienda.com.
Nice.
Jason, do you have anybody you want to shout out or anything else?
Sure. I mean, the company I work with most is So Ill, and those guys are always doing awesome stuff and they keep me super busy. I've been expanding all the current classic lines, so I've been shaping a lot. Always busy trying to do cool stuff with those guys. It's probably the biggest thing I'm into lately. Designing a couple random gyms right now too, and also Hueco Tanks the park. Like, you know, with the whole pandemic thing, it's crazy out there. It's, you know, those guys are doing an awesome job, like trying to get people in there climbing and trying to keep it safe. And I mean, even in the long term, you know, just communicating with climbers. In my experience with the book, talking with them, just making sure everything was legit. And I feel like they're totally on the climber side. And I don't know if that was true, like, you know, 10 years ago. And check out the book, Wolverine Publishing. If you search Wolverine Publishing, Hueco Tanks, you can get the copy of the book. It's only $35. It's pretty cheap and pretty much everything you need to know about North Mountain.
And doesn't a dollar of it go to the Hueco Tanks Climbers
Coalition? Yes, also. The Climbers Coalition, Hueco Tanks, dollar goes to the coalition.
Awesome. It's a great book. I got it, and I started flipping through it at the beginning of the pandemic or the quarantine, mm-hmm. and I was like, I had to stop looking at it because I was actually just about to go to Hueco. Like, literally, right, they closed Hueco on Friday, and we were supposed to leave on Wednesday, yeah. And then I was just so sad. I'm like, oh. Yeah.
Did you have the book then or not?
No, yet? I got it afterwards.
Okay. Yeah.
So, but next time I go, I'll take the book with me and I will report back as to how I found it. And I decided to go last for shout outs because my shout outs today are going to be a total cop out because I wanted to shout out Emily for helping me. She has a pickup truck. She helped me get the wood from Home Depot to my house for the wall, which went up yesterday. And I wanted to shout out Jason for Hueco. I've only been there 4 times. It's one of my favorite places on earth. And I appreciate you putting in the effort to update the guidebook. And really, to me, you're kind of the voice of Hueco Tanks, whether or not you want to be or not. At least in my eyes, you are. You're out there, spreading the word about not climbing when it's wet and, the ethics of all that stuff. And like, when we were out there, it was raining. And I know Rocco canceled our one day out there. But you said it was too wet to climb. And I was like, all right, Jason says it's too wet to climb. It's too wet to climb. So,
awesome.
Anyway, I just want to shout out both of you for, Emily, for your help and everything that you do for the podcast and everything. And Jason for, everything that you do as well. So.
Awesome. Thank you.
You are.
For sure. That's all that we have for you all today. Thank you so much.
Bye.